Good morning. That's gorgeous. That was the Dawn Chorus from Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve in Cove from the Mooney Goes Wild team. And you'll need a bit of that before this.
Tánaiste, you created the system. You supported the system. You cheerleaded the system. You rolled out the red carpet for these funds to come in. You turbocharged them. And now they're snapping up and have been doing so for a number of years, properties from first-time buyers.
Tánaiste, I think the government has become what can only be described as a circular firing squad. Fianna Fáil TDs are blaming Fine Gael for the housing crisis, and Fine Gael TDs are blaming Fianna Fáil.
We have extortionate rents being charged by these same entities in my area, no less than €2,000 a month, up to €3,000 and €3,500. This is a result of a direct, deliberate and indeed ideological, to use your favourite word, policy of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, facilitating, incentivising and encouraging these bloodsuckers.
Well now, Piers Doherty, Roisin Shortall and Richard Boyd Barrett from Thursday's Dáil, courtesy of Drive Time. Because when big institutional investors snapped up homes in new housing estates ahead of first-time buyers... outrage. But let's go back. On Tuesday, Dara O'Brien, Minister for Housing, Local Government and Heritage, spoke to Mary on Morning Ireland in advance of his affordable housing bill.
I want to move on to what has been happening in Maynooth, where we have seen housing area, units, 174 units, only 22 of them in private hands, the rest being bought up now by an investment trust. What are you going to do? And you did have proposed legislation when you were in opposition to deal with this. What are you going to do?
I flagged this actually a number of weeks ago before the situation in Maynooth came up. And I, just to be very straight, I don't approve of international investors buying housing estates in bulk like has happened here. I want to be very clear on that. Do investors have a role in housing in Ireland? Yes, of course they do, as they do in most Western European countries. But what I would say is that where funds are coming in and taking homes away effectively from families is a concern of mine. And that's why in October 2019, I did introduce a bill that I flagged a number of weeks ago, actually, publicly, that I was working on as well now, to see how we could bring in parts of this bill. And that would provide for a specific percentage of lands in private development to be limited for purchase by first-time buyers only.
Now, what percentage?
Well, we're up to 30%. That was as the bill was published.
Why not ban them completely? In countries like Germany, these investment trusts are banned from involvement in residential developments.
Well, I think, look, as I said to you earlier on, what consequences we would have by banning any type of investment coming into the country, I think that would be a pretty radical move and might have unintended consequences. Whilst it might be a good soundbite for people to throw out there and maybe populist in that sense, it would have potentially very serious ramifications.
Yeah, but are we looking at a situation? No, Minister, let me make this very quick point. Are we now looking at a situation where investment trusts are buying up homes meant for first-time buyers and then they're going to be renting these homes to the Council for Social Housing?
No. Well, look, two things. Firstly, this isn't a new phenomenon, unfortunately. I'm looking at what we can do on the planning side of things. Two, relates to tax treatment. Frankly, this isn't just a housing issue. We need to actually see a whole-of-government approach on this to see in relation to the why would it be so lucrative for funds like this to purchase a bulk purchase of properties like this. Fundamentally, what we need to see is where investment's appropriate, yes, it should happen. It shouldn't happen at the expense of first-time buyers.
Later, Sinn Féin's housing spokesperson Eoin O'Brien and Billy Kelleher, Fianna Fáil MEP for Ireland South, joined Clare. Here's Billy.
It's just interesting to hear what this the founder of this company that bought all the houses in Kildare, according to Michael Brennan's report. His name is Michael Bickford, and he said that the purchase is further evidence of the strong appeal of the Irish buy-to-rent sector for institutional capital, attracted by its resilient long-term yields. Now, he's referring there to the purchase in Bay Meadows, which was another one they bought up. Hollystown in Dublin 15, they bought 112 family homes there along with another firm. But he's outlined there what the attractiveness of the Irish market for these guys.
And that's because of the scarcity of supply. We simply are not building enough houses. We have a scarcity of supply. Why, even an economy that's even growing during the pandemic is still growing. You have a young population coming on stream, and until such time as we get on top of supply. But Owen's view that you just simply cut these out of the market entirely, who's actually going to fund the construction? Irish builders can't get loans from Irish banks. Somebody has to provide the capital to actually build the houses in the first place. Government should do its role in terms of affordable and social housing, but we need to increase supply. So the idea you would cut off these companies coming in, you know, would undermine our capacity to build. But what we don't want is to confer a disadvantage on the first-time buyer against these rates in terms of purchasing the in supply.
And then Claire put this listener's text to Owen O'Brien.
Tom says, Owen, that councils are outbidding people as much as property funds. And we know in this case in Kildare that the housing agency Tua was also in and hoping to buy up some of this property. So maybe the problem for first-time buyers, or the competition for first-time buyers, isn't just coming from the institutional investor.
Sure, and the biggest problem there is government is not investing enough in the direct delivery of genuinely affordable homes to rent or buy. We need a doubling of capital investment and the delivery of thousands of affordable homes by local authorities and approved housing bodies annually, not the paltry few hundred that are promised this year, next year and the year after. But also Billy is confusing short-term high-yield vulture funds, which is the entities that we want to see out of the Irish market, and long-term low-yield pension funds who actually build and rent properties at reasonable prices. Many of those long-term, low-yield pension funds won't come into the Irish market, many of the big European players, because of the casino-type tax policies that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have been advocating. So let me say this. We need action on the tax side. We need action on the public delivery of genuine affordable homes to rent or buy. But I actually haven't heard Billy Kelleher make an actual proposal for what he actually wants the government to do. And I haven't heard any actual proposals from the government. So when they put something on the table...
We will evaluate it.
Just let him respond there, Owen, please. Billy, go ahead. Owen, stop for a second. Yeah. Billy, what are you saying?
Owen spends his life evaluating. Of course, he has never, ever once, or their party, provided as much as one house for shared or affordable housing in the history of the state. But what we will do today is Dara O'Brien, the Minister for Housing, will take a bill to Cabinet. And I look forward to Owen O'Brien's analysis of it, but more importantly, his support for it.
However, on Late Debate, yes, Katie and Co are back. There was no arguing with Solidarity People Before Profit TD Breed Smith, although Fine Gael's Fergus O'Dowd did try.
They're called after birds, they're vultures, they're cuckoos, and they are everywhere. And they are cleaning up in profits, and they pay very little, if any, tax on them. And this has been structured by all governments for the last decade to invite in the so-called investors who just gobble up the property, and property is no longer seen as housing is supposed to be about a home. It's supposed to be about investment, and this has been deliberate government policy for years now.
The investment
and
in
Fergus, it's a bit too late now to be shouting about it unless you're prepared to do something about it.
I'm being consistent in everything I've
always said. Putting the word affordable in front of housing doesn't make it affordable.
I haven't changed at all. I'm making the same points as I always made.
But then,
and the point is very clear, and the point was very strong at our party, that that must not be allowed to continue.
I'm afraid you're not going to get away with that. Your party's been in power for too long to get away with that.
Late Debate on Wednesday. And by the end of the week, coalition parties had agreed to block investment funds from buying up housing estates. On Friday, journalist Owen Harris spoke to Sarah on Drive Time. Harris had co-founded an anonymous Twitter account under the name Barbara J. Pym. And the account was permanently suspended by Twitter because of the account's violation of Twitter rules on platform manipulation and spam. And the editor of the Sunday Independent had terminated Harris's contract with the newspaper, with Mr. English saying comments by the account frequently went far beyond what I would describe as fair and reasonable comment. Under no circumstances would such material have been published in our paper. Sarah spoke to Owen Harris and started by asking him to outline his involvement in the controversial account.
you know, I'm a weekly political columnist and my politics are well known, but I couldn't really visit my readers every week with all the stuff in Northern Ireland that I wanted to address. And particularly, I was a close friend of David Irvine and a friend of Gusty Spence, and I have very strong views about the Protestant and loyalist working class. And I felt that we had become very alienated, and I wanted access to mostly loyalists and unionists to assure them that many people in the Republic had no agenda against them and no designs on them and no malign intentions about them. And I could do that on that site. And by the way, Sarah, there's a long tradition of anonymous pamphleteering. The American Founding Fathers all did it. Edmund Burke did it. I had no problem admitting my involvement when I was asked about it. But others on the site were a bit loath to do so because they're just afraid of Sinn Féin. And of course, that is the context of the whole of this whole thing is my politics. And
And Sarah asked him about one particular tweet from that account.
Were you the person who tweeted from the Barbara Pym account about how an Irish Examiner journalist had liked a tweet that was related to a Sinn Féin TD, and the comment from the Barbara Pym account was there had been an imbecile like by an Irish Examiner hack. No, for once, it was not Aoife Moore.
I don't remember it, and I don't any recall of it, and I don't remember doing it. I certainly didn't do it myself. I've no knowledge of it.
Okay. Do you think that's a benign tweet?
You're extremely well informed. You did a lot of digging. It's a pity you wouldn't do that kind of digging into Sinn Féin's ABU account. You did. RT did not deal with the ABU situation at all until it became a major story. It's amazing the amount of digging you do with Sinn Féin's lone political opponent, because I'm almost alone in Ireland in warning about the danger of Sinn Féin fascism. And RT, which never invites me on, sits down and you do a lot of digging with your researchers, and yet you never do any digging into Sinn Féin's carry-on.
Okay, and do you think that is a benign tweet, to call an Irish Examiner hack and imbecile? And then mention that for once it wasn't Aoife Moore.
It depends on what the journalist had done or had written. Like if they had written some of the stuff that many Irish journalists do that enables Sinn Féin, that helps Sinn Féin in its campaigns, then it probably was justified. Okay. But I don't know the context because you're being coy about it.
Yeah, well, I'm not being coy about it. I read you out the tweet.
I heard the tweet, but I have to know the context and the name of the journalist and what the journalist had written before
okay,
I'd say
so there is some context in which it's okay to tweet from an anonymous account that somebody's
named. Hey, I name names every Sunday in my column. I'm not Charlie of naming names. This is all kind of Dirtban Lumgan, Dirtban Lee stuff. Mm. Bottom line is I'm one of the only journalists in Ireland that tackles Sinn Féin at the hard end. I opened up a new account to deal with them in Northern Ireland. Yes, if I made mistakes, it was like not out of any malice, it was because of my genuine, deep conviction that Sinn Féin is a malign force on this island.
So do you think, Owen, there was anything in any of the tweets that were sent out by the Barbara Pym account that were abusive, hurtful, misogynistic, any of those things?
Sir, I do not. I think there were robust political tweets aimed at very tough political people.
Okay, and the reason you sent them out anonymously is because it didn't occur to you that you could use your own name and get advice from
the people.
It
certainly occurred to me to use my own name, but I just felt that if I was with a group of people that I just didn't want to be just sitting there having to, you know, consult with them all the time. It was much simpler to do it like this, but I'm not afraid of... There's nothing kind of problematical about anonymity in my view. Anonymity has been the basis of pamphleteering polemics for centuries.
And Owen Harris did not feel he had anything to apologise for.
Do you apologise to the very many people on social media who are saying in the last 24 hours that they found the tweets from this account to be hurtful and abusive?
I can't help it if other people are offended. And I'm not apologising to anybody.
Owen Harris with Sarah McInerney on Friday's Drive Time. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Half the population will experience the menopause, but it's a topic not often openly discussed. This week's On Liveline give voice to the many women whose experiences of menopause were difficult, distressing and very isolating. Sally Ann started the conversation and her list of symptoms, quite staggering.
I had cyclical depression, I had tinnitus with ringing in my ears, I had night sweats, I had flushes, I had migraine with aura, I had tingling, I had dizzy spells, I had all over body pain, I had vertigo, I had brain fog, I had digestive issues, I had issues with my teeth, I was permanently exhausted, I didn't sleep, and the list goes on and on and on.
Wow.
this started at 35 for me. Mm-hmm. By the age of 38-ish, I was completely unhinged because of everything that was going on. I was back and forth to GPs, to specialists, to everybody and anybody, and not one of them had an absolute clue, despite me doing my own research and saying, listen, guys, this is menopause. You know, it was a very long, very, very tough mm-hmm. journey. And towards the end of it, before I got better, I did become suicidal. And as I highlighted in the email, that's a huge area because the suicide rates for women in their 50s peak globally. And that is not a coincidence. And I was nearly a statistic, mm-hmm. but thankfully I'm not.
For Sally Ann, the answer had been hormone replacement therapy, HRT, something that would come up again and again. Because women started phoning into Liveline, phoning in their droves, to talk about the often devastating impact of the symptoms of the menopause on their lives. Here's Terry talking about her experience of hot flushes.
Well, how many would you get?
A day?
Yeah.
Oh, could be 10, 12. Back at the moment, I'm roasting. I'm sitting here at the moment, and if I had my two hands, I'd be taking off my cardigan. Hot around the back of the neck. My torso, my whole torso gets really hot. And I'd go to bed at night time and get into a cold bed or even put on the electric blanket and within 5 minutes I'm throwing the clothes off. And all through the night. Now, there's never a night that I would sleep a whole night through. I would definitely wake 5 or 6 times.
And Nolene.
One of your callers mentioned 20 plus a day.
Hot flushes, yeah.
Yeah, I stopped counting when I got to 18 one day. And each one lasted about 5 minutes because it's not just a quick wave of sweat. It's like a dry, burning heat and then this drenching. Like my whole body would be wet down about as far as my knees. And then you're chilled because this wet,
sweat comes out to try and cool the body.
Yeah, exactly. But each one would actually last about 5 minutes and you would actually be having to mop your brow.
And Loretta.
Joe, I used to get 20 to 30 hot flushes a day, every day, for 3 years. I could be in the middle of making a presentation. I had senior roles in the corporate world and I could feel the sweat on my face. I could feel my hair, the bottom of my hair wet. Obviously you want to take off get as much of your clothes off as quickly as you can. It's uncomfortable and embarrassing and other people can see it and it obviously isn't good for your confidence. And then at night I had hot flushes, which would mean that I was taking the duvet was off. And so therefore my sleep was broken and it was exhausting. I can describe myself as a slow puncture.
Hot flushes joined other symptoms like anxiety and insomnia, as well as brain fog, an almost benign term for a much darker experience. Here's Tina.
I actually had never heard the word perimenopause.
Yeah, around menopause. It's
10 years before your period stops. It's 10 years before your last period is the perimenopause. And it's actually horrific because your hormones are fluctuating all the time. You're really all over the place. I'm 56 now and I'm post-menopause, or not post-menopause because there is no end to menopause, but I'm in full menopause now. And it was just a terrible experience. And it was the fact that I knew so little myself. I was actually in perimenopause and I'd never heard the word. A colleague said it to me and I actually said, what's that? And I was in my 40s. I was about 41 or 42.
Because you were still experiencing your periods and you're saying, sure, the menopause doesn't start until my periods finish.
Yeah. And so all of that, trying to hold down a job, a responsible job. And, I was in meetings and sometimes chairing meetings and nobody would have talked across me and I would have completely lose my train of thought. And I had to laugh it off. You know what I mean? That's because that's how I was dealing with it. I had to laugh it off. Everybody would laugh and I'd say, I have no idea what I was saying. And Joe, when I say I could not pick up the thread of what I was saying, not in a million years unless somebody was able to remind me and bring me back to it. It was really embarrassing and it was actually very frightening because I thought at that stage there's something wrong with my brain, And it's what people now, it's brain fog is one of the things.
And that was echoed by Imelda.
I hit 50, no issues, and then 51, I thought the same as your other callers. menopause was simply my period stopped, and I was having these hot flushes. Yeah. And you know what, Joe? I thought, these are fine, these are manageable. Sure, I was spending a fortune on things like all these supplements and everything, and some were helping, some weren't, obviously, all these therapies. But I thought, I'm fine. But unbeknownst to me, I was suffering all these other symptoms that I didn't relate to menopause at all. And like, I'm one of 12, and I have sisters older than me, but we just never knew anything. We're never educated. So like, I was getting out of bed in the morning, putting my feet on the floor, and I felt like a woman of 90. I couldn't, like, my feet, just, I had pains and aches, all my joints. I was getting pains in my shoulders, my arms. They kept moving, and I was told that I had roving arthritis. Now, as it happens, I've had scans. I have no arthritis whatsoever. I'm tired. I was getting through work, coming home exhausted. Again, like your other callers, you know, very clear and confident at work usually, but my cognitive ability, like brain fog, you see someone, can't think of their name, same again, in the middle of a meeting and you just lose track, or someone asks you something on a policy or something that normally you'd be very clear on and you're second-guessing everything. Even like my spatial awareness driving, I found, you know, I was getting flustered. I had that awful insomnia, awake, you know, you sleep for an hour or two, awake all night, up and down, running to the toilet. None of these I associated with menopause. My cholesterol was rising. I was putting on weight. I'd never put on weight in my life. I was just very tired, and I just never associated any of it with menopause, and I genuinely felt I was about 90.
Imelda on Wednesday's Live Line. And all week long, women rang in. Here's Deirdre.
I was postmenopausal now at the age of 48, okay? No periods for 12 months. Right. And I seemed to be, you know, just plodding along. And then all hell broke loose with regard to these sweats during the day. Yeah. The sweat was so bad that I couldn't wear makeup because nothing would stick. As soon as I came out of the shower, I was saturated and my hair was constantly wet. The salt in my eyes from the sweat was horrendous. And I went around for the whole winter in a T-shirt. I couldn't bear anything around my neck. Everything had to be very, very light. And at that stage, I was working in the HSC trying to roll out the swine flu program for Kildare West Wicklow. And I was working with management at that stage. It was horrendous, and I felt like I just wanted to detach my head from my body with regard to the anxiety and everything.
Bernie also phoned in.
I'm a bus driver, and I'm 53, and I'm based in Watford.
Okay.
And I'm losing so much blood, and I never know when it happens, but I could be on a bus with four passengers, and it just happens. It just floods straight through you, and my company are so unhelpful. There are no toilets available after 9 p.m. and we work till 12:15. If you try and get a few minutes break, a comfort break, you can't have it. I stopped a bus once to use a garage before COVID, garage toilets, to quickly run in and change. And a customer complained, and I was brought in for a meeting by my service manager to ask me why I had gotten off the bus to use the toilet. It's awful, Joe. I can't tell you how bad it is.
Bernie is heard on Thursday's Liveline. And very quickly, it became apparent that Liveline had touched on something rather big. The sheer volume of calls into the programme meant that they did something they'd never done before. They asked people to leave voice notes with their stories. Here are just some of them.
Dear Joe, I was delighted to hear menopause discussed on your programme today. I'm 59 and I've had no quality of life for the past 3 years. I didn't seem to become hormone deficient until I was 56 years. Then, as described by Sally Ann yesterday, my life became a hell to be endured. I couldn't sleep. I was a total insomniac. I hold a responsible job and the lack of sleep impacted hugely. I experienced hot flushes at least once an hour, lasting for up to 5 minutes, where I thought I might spontaneously combust as they were so intense. I was always extremely active and endeavoured to continue this, even though I was afflicted with joint pains and painful feet. When getting out of bed every morning, I could hardly bear to stand, the pain would be so intense. I would hobble across the room and gradually this pain would lessen and I could walk normally. However, when I would sit for any length of time, I would experience this pain on standing every time. My feet felt collapsed. It was like having plantar fasciitis all the time. I also gained weight, which no amount of exercise or healthy eating could shift. Then there are all the vaginal issues caused by atrophy. But who wants to talk about vaginas? This is a summary of some of the symptoms I experienced, and this list is not exhaustive. The Irish Menopause group on Facebook was the first experience I had of feeling that I was not alone in my misery. I was not imagining it all or exaggerating my symptoms. Other women were having similar experiences. It has been taboo for far too long.
Hi, my name is Martina. I am delighted that you're speaking today about menopause. 6 years ago, I suddenly, at age 45, developed severe panic attacks, anxiety, palpitations, itch, feeling very unwell. I ended up in A&E twice, thinking I was having a heart attack. I attended my GP. I also experienced actual severe dizziness. He was very concerned at the time that he thought I may be having mini strokes or MS. I was referred to many various disciplines, cardiology, endocrinology, neurology, over 5 years. Nobody mentioned anything to me about menopause. I've lost 5 or 6 years of my life with my children and my husband. Became very depressed, very anxious, a recluse, lost one of my jobs, lost all my self-confidence. It's really time now for the medical profession to take heed and listen and become educated and end this nightmare for women. Thank you. Bye, Joe.
Hi, Joe. The itch where you keep scratching until you bleed, even though there's nothing there. The getting into bed in your pyjamas, only to get back out of it 3 seconds later, strip yourself, strip the bed, kick the duvet off. Mood swings, the weight gain, the resulting depression, the pains in the feet. I can identify with absolutely everything these women are saying. And sometimes like that, when you can't find the words, kind of like I am now, you feel like you're going insane. Something has to be done.
Hi, Joe. My name is Sue. I'm just ringing about your show today on menopause. I am 53. I have been going through the menopause, I'd say, since I was 44, 45. I am now, for the last 4 years or more, post-menopausal. I have terrible hot flushes during the day. At night, they wake me up. Terrible mood swings, get really angry very, very easily, burst out crying very, very easily, overweight, it's just been a nightmare, and it's just great to hear that you're talking about this live on the radio, and great to hear so many other women going through the same thing. Because sometimes you feel it's just yourself.
I was 50 years of age, about 7 years ago when I started. Started with very, very heavy bleeding during periods where I, every half an hour, would have to remove myself from my customer service desk and change sanitation. It was almost impossible to work, but how do you explain to an employer that I'm bleeding very intensely here, you know, for months and months on end. The hot sweats since then, the brain fog. One of the worst symptoms now would be the vaginal atrophy. That started out with not being able to urinate properly. My wee running down the insides of my legs every time I would go to the loo. Can you imagine how you would keep yourself clean? The middle of the night, having to shower down, change your pajamas before you get back into bed. The menopause should be put on every school curriculum so that not only women, but every young man out there knows at home what his mother is going through, what his grandmother has got, is going through or has gone through, so that when he becomes a partner to somebody, that he knows exactly what is going on. Otherwise, we've been treated like we are non-existent citizens, that we're just expected to get on with our lives every day as normal.
The voices of just some of the many, many women who phone Liveline this week. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, we do like a pretty face, or just a face, because we're hardwired to remember faces. It's an evolutionary hack, it seems, that helps us identify a friend or a foe. But throw in our new accessory, the face mask. Well, how can you tell? Ray Darcy spoke to Dr. Aileen Noyes, Senior Lecturer in Cognitive Psychology at the University of Huddersfield.
What benefit would your research have, do you think?
So it's a really kind of very current question.
Yes.
Suddenly face masks are everywhere. How does this affect our ability to recognise faces? So there's the practical component. Are we going to be able to recognise our friends and family?
Yes.
There's the applied component, which is in terms of security scenarios. Would you be able to make comparisons from CCTV footage from masks and non-masked faces? And it also just helps us understand how humans recognize faces. Are they using the mouth region of the face, or is it more in the top region of the face, which is what a lot of previous research has suggested?
Now, of course, there's the other application of it, is that people will now know if they can make that excuse anymore. Oh, I didn't recognize you. You walked right past me there in the supermarket. Oh, I didn't recognise you. It must have been the mask.
Exactly.
And what about the theory that when we smile, it's with the eyes? Smiles, if you will.
And do you know anything about emotions and mask wearing?
Good question. That was also something we looked at in the study, as people have said kind of anecdotally, when I'm out in the shop, people can't tell if I'm smiling at them anymore. The results for that were kind of as expected, in that where the bottom part of the face is really important for displaying an emotion, that would reduce the accuracy on recognizing that emotion. So, for example, a happy face really uses the smile. You don't need the eyes as much. So when you cover the lower part of the face, that makes it much harder to recognize a happy face.
I thought that we smiled with our eyes.
That's something that's been quite interesting in our research, is that it does seem that the lower portion of the face seems to be important for a lot of emotions and for identification, perhaps more than was really understood previously.
And finally, word of the day, especially if you're buttering the toast.
Pareidolia.
Face pareidolia, where we see faces where faces don't even exist.
Yeah, like in toast.
So often when we'd see faces in clouds or in toast, in fruits. So that just, I think, leads back to that fact that humans are so attuned to finding faces that we do see them even when they don't exist.
So we want to see a face in something. That's the way the brain works.
I think maybe we want to see faces, and faces are so important to us, as we're such social creatures, that our brain is highly adapted to finding faces and helping us remember those familiar faces.
Face pareidolia. Love it. The drama on One this week was Quicksand by Elizabeth Moynihan. It tells the story of Joy and her son Joe, a young man living with autism, played here by Rex Ryan.
I turned the corner where the South Circular Road meets Camden Street. Bang! You hit the ground in front of me. Nose leaking blood all over. I'm shocked, but oddly, a bit giddy at the sight of it pouring down, staining your jumper. Which is red anyway. A dark brown patch below the neckline where the wool soaks it up. A woman passes by and starts shouting, "I'm calling the cops." I explain, "It's an accident." "I saw you headbutt her," she says. "I have a green belt in Kempo. My hands are weapons. I will take you down."
Gulp. Quicksand, the drama on One. Scrub, 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 squirt that sanitizer. We've all been so very busy staying safe.
Wash your hands.
But that, we hear you, Joe. But is it time to allow some decent dirt back into our lives? Well, on the news at one, filth merchant Cian McCormick ditched the hand sanitizer and went exploring the bugs and germs that live in and on us, aided by UCC Professor of Immunovirology, Liam Fanning.
The microbiome is the kind of constituents of the organisms that live within and on us. So that composition of that community of bacteria, fungi and viruses is like, it's an ecosystem that lives within us, but that, you know, we feed it and we benefit from it. While on some levels they might threaten us, on other levels we depend on them to provide us with certain types of nutrients, to digest certain types of food. Some instances maybe to provide a defense mechanism by educating our immune system against some more pathogenic bacteria. And if we start zapping everything around us, which we have with COVID, we're actually taking away plenty of these beneficial microbes.
And a recent paper from global health researchers alerted us to the unintended risk to our health because of our cleaning. Dr. Brett Finlay is the first author of the study and professor of microbiology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
History has shown us that when we deprive ourselves of these microbes, bad things happen. And so we're worried that we are depriving ourselves of these microbes due to COVID, and this is having consequences downstream. And we're going to really see this in the early kids and the elderly, especially, because that's when the microbes have the biggest effect. I mean, an early baby really needs microbial exposure to develop their brain normally, their gut normally, their immune system normally. And as you get older, post 65, your microbes fall off a cliff. And a lot of studies show that if you can be exposed to younger people's microbes kind of thing and good microbes, it actually helps prevent these microbes going bad on you, which hastens the aging process. So we predict we're going to see, you know, probably an increase in asthma and obesity, especially in the next 3 to 5 years post-COVID.
If normality is to resume again, can we go back to the pre-pandemic social norms of hugging, shaking hands, or even crowding into a room?
From how we function as a species, we really do need to get back to sharing microbes extensively, because we know that's very beneficial. You know, whatever you can do to sort of keep your microbes healthy, yet still stay away from COVID, obviously, to get vaccinated, you know, you do have to follow these health precautions. There's a reason. It's the only tools we have to it. But I think this is another experiment post-COVID. How do we behave? And I know I find myself backing away from complete strangers when I previously wouldn't have done that for no apparent reason. It's just human behavior. You know, we're so trained to be paranoid of each other now. And this is not good for microbial transmission.
From the news at one. So back to sharing microbes extensively. Okay then. And if you've been single during this pandemic, I bet you'll be only dying to do your duty. Unlike family, on Bank Holiday Monday, Brenda spoke to Ruth, a music photographer who lives on her own and who's taken up a new hobby.
Kind of was an evolution of being really bored of walking. Do you know, how do you turn a walk into something a little bit more exciting? The monotony of walking around 5K every day. But if you roller skate around 5K, it suddenly becomes interesting. And it's something you can do on your own outside. Yeah. You know, there's not a lot of things you can do on your own outside to keep yourself entertained.
She's waiting to see what will happen to her career as a music photographer.
I had a whole summer of gigs due to shoot Glastonbury. Everything was there. Everything got cancelled in the space of 2 weeks. And I was left a little bit devastated, to say the least. Then I really kind of went into myself. But that's a good thing when you're an artist. Do you know what I mean? To really kind of sit with your idleness and your thoughts. And I came up with this idea, which involved me photographing people through their windows at twilight during lockdown, which apparently resonated with a whole host of people, including book publishers, because then out of that came my book Twilight Together, A Portrait of Ireland at Home. And sure, look, here we are,
rollerblading.
Yeah.
And Ruth can't wait to get out and about and, yes, get those microbes mingling.
But the pandemic showed us just how different people's lives are. You know, that pandemic hit people very, very differently. Do you know, this actually came to light, you know, recently when the government kind of toyed with that idea of giving the vaccines to 18 to 30 year olds. And that suddenly excludes me, right? A 35-year-old single person who's desperate to get back on the set. But loads of my friends were all like, oh, I think that's very fair. And I'm like, you're married. You're married with kids. Your life hasn't changed much during this pandemic. My life has changed. Give me back my life.
And when she does get out there?
Yeah, I mean, I do miss rocking up to lads in the smoking area and bumming a cigarette, even though I don't smoke, like. So, I mean, that's something. I am appreciating this lockdown because it gives me a chance to be single, because I have a history of falling in love very quickly, going from one relationship to the next, to the next, to the next, which is very bad for people. And it's only now I can stand back and realise what I was doing. So this pandemic has gone, no, you stop there. You're going to be single for a year, whether you like it or not. So I'm just kind of appreciating that. But I also think, this is my theory, right? After lockdown ends, and this is what I say to my other friends who are single, I'm like, don't worry, we haven't missed a year. All those people out there, they've just spent a year honing their skills, you know, their domestic skills. They've all become perfect partners. They've all realized what it is they're looking for in life. So that when this ends, we're going to be faced with a bunch of single people who are ready to commit. And that is just, all it's done is kind of taken away the faff. Do you know what I mean? The first few weeks of a relationship, like, I'm really looking for a relationship. Everybody is going to be wanting, they either want a relationship or they don't. And everyone's just going to be so clear about it, lay the cards on the table. That's going to save us a lot of time in the end. So this is what that pandemic has done. It saved us time.
But she did admit that not everything about this time had been positive.
Has it taken away time?
It stole a very, very pivotal part of my career that I don't know if I'll ever get back. Because I was on the cusp of, I felt like I was on the cusp of going big with my music photography. I'd only just started to really consider myself a really well-renowned music photographer. You know, stepping onto tour buses, shooting the pyramid stage at Glastonbury. That was my, they're my dreams, my goals. And I'd started to bloody well tick them off in the second thing came crashing down. So yeah, I do feel a little bit hard done by that. And people kind of say to me, it's like, oh, but you wrote a book. I'm like, I'd swap it in a heartbeat to have that back. I would. And just, but there's nothing, you can't cry over it any more than I've already done. It's grief. You have to grieve and move on and go, okay, that's what happened, get over it.
Ruth with Brenda on Like Family. And speaking of out and about, Trina McCarthy, beauty columnist with the Sunday Independent, came into studio, yes, studio, to Clare, along with her sparkly shoes.
I was short of coming up here in a full-on ball gown to see you because I was so excited.
You're getting out.
To leave the house. Actually, you should see the shoes. I'm the sparkliest shoes you've ever seen in your life.
Barely walking them,
but the excitement of putting on shoes with a hard sole. Oh, my goodness.
And Karina.
Oh, we're up the town now. And what about Monday when the hairdresser's open?
Can we actually just take a little moment of silence for what all the beauty professionals will be facing in the week's time or whatever? My goodness. They're like the new rock stars or elite athletes or something, because they're going to have to deal with a whole lot of what we've been doing at home. But I think there's two types of people, actually. I was thinking about this on my way up. There's the type of person that at an ungodly hour on May 9th, you know, was texting their hairdresser or beauty professional or whatever, saying, get me in. And they will be down outside the door before they've even flipped the open sign on the door. And then there's the people that actually have got quite used to doing their thing, you know, doing their beauty bits and at home. And they might just wait till the dust settles and continue what they're doing.
Which is butchering our own hair, because really, which of us makes a good fist of the back bits? Tricky. Now, Trina was joined on the line by Karina Grehan, co-owner of Nell's Closet in Athlone. And both women confidently declared 2021 the summer of
Layering.
Thermal vest, summer dress like cardigan, Aran cardigan, folding raincoat, waders and bikini. Layering.
We're going to spend the whole summer outside.
Yeah, it's going to be very much all about layering.
Yeah.
So whatever, as many layers as we can have, because we all know this country, by 7-8 o'clock in the afternoon, we're going to be freezing.
Particularly if this week was anything to go by. Well, that is almost it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And as Colm O'Regan reminded us, it's not as if we're going anywhere.
Staycation once again. Staycation once again. And Ireland still not COVID-free. Staycation once again.